Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadill, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. We have a great show tonight featuring Sherry Seymour with The Last Circle, published by Trine Day Press. It's a title of Danny Casolaro's investigation into the octopus and the Promise, PROMIS software scandal. Well, folks, it's about a lot more than that, for sure. Should be coming at the bottom of the hour. Prepare for an intense discussion. Actually, conversation. I'm going to keep it easy. It's a very complicated book. Dealing with multi-levels of corruption. It is deep conspiracy and history combined. 18 years in the making, this book, The Last Circle by Sherry Seymour. Meanwhile, in the first half hour, I've got some local news to give you about the Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Young Americans for Liberty at University of Kansas coming up, and also some Lawrence Sustainability Network news. Plenty of stuff to get real with. Before we really get real with Sherry Seymour, maybe we should play some old music. Maybe some old music before we get into this.
Thank you.
Yes, this coming Friday, October 22nd at Alderson Auditorium at the Kansas Union, University of Kansas, the White Flag Warrior Tour. They're launching Operation Recovery to help get the troops from Iraq home. It's part of the Young Americans for Liberty and the Iraq Veterans Against War. Guests will include Ethan McCord, who give testimony to footage of his unit and himself in the infamous WikiLeaks video, Collateral Murder, Dealing with Trauma. Chris Hopkins will also be on the panel discussing his role in the invasion of Iraq and Kansas outreach to Fort Riley troops and Manhattan area students and veterans. William Stewart Starks, detailing the Operation Recovery, a veteran and community-driven campaign to stop the deployment of traumatized service members. There will be a local veteran panel and a Q&A on organizing a local campaign to allow troops their right to heal following the presentation. Again, that's at Alderson Auditorium, Kansas Union, University of Kansas, Friday, October 22nd, in Lawrence, Kansas, beginning at 7 p.m. Some news they don't want you to know about. Also, this just in a few days ago from Kevin Zeese about money, big money, and elections. Runs about 15 minutes. I'll be back with you. Listeners, I have on the other end of the phone Kevin Zeese with prosperityagenda.us. And I subscribed to his newsletter, and I strongly encourage listeners to subscribe to it. Just go to prosperityagenda.us and sign up. And there's an incredible email he sent, his organization sent me a few days ago, actually just last Friday. Well, first off, welcome to Radio Free Kansas, Mr. Zeese.
Well, thanks for having me on again. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, it is. Well, it's good to hear your voice. Out here in Kansas, we're in a wash. It's just nonstop advertisements. Half the time, you can't tell who's there. It's so fast. They don't even say, I am so-and-so, unless it's a candidate. There's all these different groups. It makes my head spin. I can't figure out who's who. And you did something quite unusual just last week, didn't you?
Well, yeah, we see the same problem happening across the country. In fact, this is an unusual election year. In fact, it's the first election year after the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, which allowed corporations to spend unlimited money on elections. And as a result, what's happened has been, particularly on the conservative side of the ledger, there's been all sorts of new nonprofit groups created for the main purpose of trying to influence the election. And they set these nonprofits up in order to avoid election laws that require identification of donors. And so you have anonymous donors to these groups that sound nice, like American Prosperity or American Crossroads or Jobs for America or whatever.
Yeah.
But what they really are businesses who are trying to elect people who they can control, who will support their big business agenda. That really is not good for jobs, really is not good for the economy, not good for America, not in the public interest. And they're hiding their donations because they don't want you to know that it's the oil companies, the bankers, the Wall Street, and, those kinds of folks who are trying to influence the outcome of the election. So what we did, we filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission seeking that they stop these groups from operating, and that they require them to disclose their donors.
Mm.
Voters know who is funding these ads. And we also wrote a letter to the Department of Justice, which has authority on the criminal side of election laws, to enforce the federal election laws, and to do so with criminal investigations to see if these laws are being violated. If what's being reported in the media is true, it's a very clear violation, because these nonprofit groups are not supposed to be election programs are supposed to be advocacy groups, and not supposed to be trying to influence the outcome of elections with most of their money. Unlike what's happening today, is groups are being set up just for the purpose of influencing elections and taking anonymous contributions to do it.
Yeah, and it's really strange trying to track it down. I was reading somewhere, I think it was on your website, that it came out that American Crossroads has given almost 8 times the amount of money to Republican candidates as they have versus the Democrats, and it's just it's hard tracking. My Rupert Murdoch, owner of Newsday and Fox News and all the other stuff he owns, Glenn Beck, gave $1 million. Now we know that $1 million to the Republican Governors Association, and then plopped down another $1 million to the Chamber of Commerce,
right.
And matched the first one was a matching donation from one of the Koch brothers, who listeners, Koch Industries down in Wichita, Kansas. That's where their home base is at. He plopped down $1 million. One of the Koch brothers plopped down $1 million, matching grant to the Republican Governors Association on the same day that Rupert Murdoch did. It's just at least we know that, but I don't even know.
Yeah,
how
those are at least public contributions, and we know the Republican Governors Association supports Republican candidates. The groups like American Crossroads, and they have two groups actually. They have a legitimate group, I would call legitimate, in that it's obeying the election laws. That's a political action committee. Then they have what I would call an illegitimate group, which is American Crossroads GPS, which is a nonprofit lobbying group. And most of the money is going to the nonprofit, and that's where we don't know the sources of the money. We do know the sources of their political action committee, and the sources are essentially oil and gas, military-industrial complex, insurance industry, and that's who's funding that. We don't know who's funding the other one. And now these groups don't give money to candidates. They run their own independent campaigns. And so it's not like they're giving money to all Republican candidates. What they're doing is they're running ads in support of Republican candidates or against Democrats.
Right.
And this year, this election year, this first post-Citizens United election, we're going to have $200 million of anonymous donations leading to advertisements on our airwaves. So voters will not know who funded $200 million of advertisements. This is the greatest democracy crime since Watergate. And we really need to see the Department of Justice and the Federal Elections Commission and the IRS taking action. These actions violate the Internal Revenue Code statute on nonprofit organizations and violate the federal election laws. And so the Department of Justice and the Federal Election Commission have jurisdiction to deal with that. So we need to see these agencies stepping up and enforcing the law and not letting this democracy crime go unpunished.
Yeah. Well, another thing I noticed that, and you're not you hardly agree with either party on, you're an independent like me.
I'm very much an independent, yes.
But you said that the DNC chair, Tim Kaine, in your email said that that's the biggest election scandal since Watergate. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff, man.
Well, $200 million of cash that's anonymous going into ads. Again, what's also starting to be seen is around the country, a lot of these ads are false. And so candidates are going to TV stations and challenging the ads, and they get taken off the air when the station looks at the content and sees that they're false. So you have anonymous donors putting up false ads, trying to deceive the public and manipulate the vote. This is not what our democracy needs. We already have money too much controlling elections, and now we're having anonymous money with false ads trying to control the elections. This is exactly the wrong way for the country to be going, and we need to see people step up and do something about this.
Well, now, you said that the only way to stop this is through the Department of Justice. Have you had any luck with that?
Well, we haven't had a response yet from the Department of Justice. I mean, if the Federal Election Commission was functional, that would be another way. But the Federal Election Commission was designed not to work. There's 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans as the commissioners, and so that always leads to a 3-3 deadlock and nothing ever gets done. So the FEC has the power, but because of the way it's been set up not to work, and so it doesn't work. The Department of Justice has jurisdiction over criminal violations, and if they announce a criminal investigation into the funding of these nonprofits and their use of money, anonymous contributions for elections, that would be a dramatic step that would make the donors realize that they may not be able to stay anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be a very big step forward just to make that announcement, and that would, I think, slow this process down. Time is running out, though. We're seeing an incredible pollution of the airwaves. As you mentioned, in Kansas you're seeing it. We're seeing it across the country, an incredible pollution of airwaves by, these nice-sounding groups with anonymous donors, and it's really a devastating thing to our democracy.
Yeah, and listeners, the full complaint, and I opened it up, is it's at prosperityagenda.us. Go there. I downloaded and read it. It's great. I mean, talk about legalese. I mean, this stuff is a serious complaint, you know. And you cite the law, letter and verse of what's.
Well, the law's on our side. That's one thing about this. This is not a gray question either.
Right.
If what's been told in the press is true, and that's what we need investigators to find out. But if the press is reporting it accurately, this is not a gray area case. This is black and white. They are violating both the tax laws and the election laws. And right now, no one is doing anything to stop this democracy crime from occurring.
Well, if we want, if listeners, now here's a straight up, and it doesn't have to be anonymous. As a matter of fact, we probably wouldn't take it if it was anonymous. You can support Kevin Zeese and the work at prosperityagenda.us. Just go there. Send him a donation. I strongly support listeners to do that. You can do a one-time donation, or better yet, become a monthly sustainer.
We really appreciate that. Thank you so much for saying that. I'll tell you why we got involved in this. Prosperity Agenda's purpose is to try to remake the economy so that it really benefits the people in a way that is more just. I mean, we have an economy right now where the top 1% is benefiting and the bottom 95% is stagnant or falling. And we need to change that. And the way to do that really is to democratize the economy, to really open it up so people have more control of their economic lives. They have more influence on the direction of the country, and where we have a country that really works for the people and not for the corporations. And we see corporate power, concentrated corporate power, not the mom-and-pop businesses, not the small, medium-sized businesses that are so important to our country, but we have concentrated corporate power, especially on Wall Street, that dominates the economy, and we have to confront that. And what we're seeing in these elections is concentrated corporate power, you know, working to put in place legislators who will do their and that will be bidding that will hurt small businesses, it will hurt medium-sized businesses, it will hurt employees, hurt jobs prospects. It's not a good step for anybody except for concentrated wealth.
Well, it's certainly happening out here in a really bizarre way. I mean, the advertisements are, you know, they seem to be issue-oriented. And then they, of course, steer you towards the candidate that they favor, which is 90% of the time a Republican. And it's just an amazing, it's a social phenomenon I've never seen in my 55 years on the planet, and it really bugs me to nonstop, because I don't think a lot of people, like some of my, I don't think my grandmother, if she was alive, would understand it. It just whizzes by their face, and they just hear the smear, and I'm afraid they'll just go pull the lever based on the smear, and they don't have any way of really tracking it down. Or hearing to borrow a pun from Sarah Palin, or even to hear the refutation of it. And it's sort of out here in Kansas where we're staring down the gun barrel of just a solid Republican state government, Brownback as a governor. It's an incredible array. I don't know. Do you, I don't want to get off the subject too much, but I want to ask you a question. Do you think the Republican Party is, Max Blumenthal, I just finished his book, Republican Gomorrah. I'm trying to get him on my show. But, you know, he claims that the movement shattered the party. And do you think that's why we're seeing so much a big, strong takeover by the Republicans here in Kansas? It's sort of like the roosters are coming home to roost and they're taking over. I mean, I can't understand why that's such a... I mean, did the Tea Party thing shatter the Republican Party? Are they on the retreat or what? What do you think?
No, well, what's happened, I think, with the Republican Party is they have adapted to this new post-Citizens United world much more quickly than Democrats have. A combination of that with Michael Steele as the Republican National Committee Chairman. I mean, there's not a lot of confidence in Michael Steele.
Oh.
There's been some shenanigans about what he spent money on, his expense accounts, and his rhetoric, and his public speaking, lots of problems with that. So a lot of big donors wanted to find somewhere else to put their money. I don't see this as a Tea Party thing. This is a corporate, big business, concentrated corporate power move, not the Tea Party. Tea Party is not the money source. And so the money is moving away from the Republican Party. Some people call this a coup d'etat of the Republican Party. Essentially, the power has moved from outside the party to inside these front group nonprofits, where the donations can be anonymous and where they can be unlimited. there are limits to how much money a person can give to a political party.
Right.
There's no limits to how much money they can give to a nonprofit. And so with the concentration of wealth going the way it has been for the last 10 years, really the last 30 years, but especially in the last 10 years, so that the top 1% has wealth equal to the bottom 95% of the people. There's so much money in that top 1% that, you know, they don't want to be limited by campaign contribution laws.
Uh-huh.
They want to be able to give as much as they can. And so they moved outside the Republican Party, moved away from Michael Steele, set up these nonprofit organizations run by political operatives like Karl Rove, and it's become a very much a corrupted system that's no longer transparent, where it's all anonymous, and we have no idea who's funding what and what their special interests are, what they're trying to get out of government. Because that's what this is about. This is about crony capitalism.
Yeah.
This is about government funding big business, concentrated wealth, taking taxpayer dollars and funding it through crony capitalism, through corporate welfare, to big business interests. And that's what this is all about. It's about shifting tax dollars into the pockets of the top 1%.
And that's why. That's right. And that brings it to an end. We've got another news report that just came in from Ken Gibson out of Lawrence, Kansas. It was, and thank you to Kevin Zeese for giving me that time. Again, his place is prosperityagenda.us. I encourage you to go there. Sign up for their free newsletter. You'll get it every week. prosperityagenda.us. Sister Jane Gibson writes in from Lawrence, Kansas, at a special one last time to stop the sunflower coal plant sent in by the Lawrence Sustainability Network News on behalf of Stephanie Cole with the Sierra Club, I believe. Email, I know the let's see, it's basically there's a current coming up. It's exactly 3 years ago, October 18th, 2007, when Secretary Brenby, that's of the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, KDHE, denied the permit for the coal plant in Holcomb, Kansas. If the without voter participation, there would be surely plans progressing for two, if not three, more coal plants to be built in far western Kansas, Holcomb. So there is a point of involvement. I know it's cut down to one mega plant, and they're writing that you need to the comment period with the comment period with the Kansas Department of Health and Environment Bureau of Air is coming up due. They must be submitted by October 23rd. That's this coming Saturday. You can email comments to, here you go, here's the email address to send your comments about this last coal plant, which is, you know, still in the air, folks, this last coal plant. Email your comments to, it's all one word here, sunflowercomments, that's sunflowercomments at kdheks.gov. Again, that's sunflowercomments, all one word, at kdheks.gov. You can also mail it by snail mail to KDHE Bureau of Air, Attention Sunflower Comments, 1000 Southwest Jackson, Suite 310, Topeka, Kansas, 66612-1366. Again, by snail mail, you can mail your protest in about the proposed coal plant in Holcomb coming up at KDHE Bureau of Air, Attention Sunflower Comments, 1000 Southwest Jackson, Suite 310, Topeka, Kansas, zip code 66612-1366. There's more information, fact sheets, and also sample comments at the website www.beyondcoalkansas. That's one word, beyondcoalkansas.org. And also a group that I happen to have worked with in terms of going to the State House and standing in the state in the lawn of the State House Capitol building and protesting the coal plants, www.gpace.org. That's GPACE, gpace.org. We'll go to both of those websites, Beyond Coal Kansas
org and GPACE org. You can get some sample comments to mail in. Play one last song, and by the way, we're expecting our call coming in from Sherry Seymour and her latest book, The Last Circle, published by Trine Day. It's incredible, perfect material for Wednesday Mystery. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You can call in. Feel free to call in at the top of the hour. Area code 646-716-8652. I'm really happy to have her on tonight. And it's a sort of a Heidi Ho by Cab Calloway, 1937. We'll be right back.
Brother William Shakespeare, thanks for a great idea. I took one look in your book on Romeo and Juliet. Now I'm all set. I'm just a hidey-ho Romeo, and I'm looking for a Juliet. Now at this Barrymore business, I may be new, but up in Harlem, I met a fat man. I can teach John a thing or two. I'm searching high and low, high de ho de ho. Once I find her, I'll be set. And for emergency, I carry with me a ladder for to climb right into her balcony. I'm just a high-de-ho, Romeo, looking for a Juliet. Ha, 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 ha. Looking for a Juliet.
Cab Calloway, 1937, Heidi Ho Romeo. Maybe we could Romeo. Maybe leave it up to me. Maybe I could get Miss Seymour on the phone here. You know, out here in Kansas. We have a way of getting the information. You are about to hear one of the damnedest stories you'll ever hear in your life. And I'm not going to let her tell all of it. because you'll need to get her book. That's right. And a great book it is. It took her 18 years. 18 years to do that. Private investigator. That's some private work. Did some private investigating work with me. Well, not with me, but I did private investigating. As you know, listeners, I used to be a PI and newspaper editor, publisher. Well, Sherry Seymour has done a little bit of all that and a lot more stringent than I. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. Sherry Seymour, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Well,
can you hear me? I'm wearing a headset. Shall I take it off, or is it all right to use the headset?
No, actually, no, it sounds wonderful. That's fine.
Great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just starting to try to get my listeners warmed up because I give them the full title, The Last Circle. By, again, readers, it's fresh out. Late September, it came out in print finally after Ms. Seymour's 18-year investigation. It's the full name is The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro's Investigation into the Octopus and the Promise Software Scandal. And it is a big book, listeners. It's something you can really chew on for quite a while. I've had it the book for a month, and I'm like three-quarters of the way, Sherry. Can I call you Sherry?
You can.
Yeah, and I'm three-quarters of the way.
Yeah, 600 pages.
I know. And I don't tell me about the ending because it just gets better and better. It reads like a mystery, but it's got all these, well, it's sort of like the Octopus. It's got all these tentacles that goes off tangentially. These different, the Department of Justice, undercover informants, and I guess there's a record company, or it's more than that. What is MCA? Help me out. Let's start off with how you started this book. Where
MCA
were you at? Where
is
were
Music
you at?
Corporation of America.
Yeah.
It owned Universal Studios in Hollywood, and it was the major entertainment corporation in the United States in its time.
Uh-huh. And they're involved in this, too, up to their neck, by
right.
the way. So.
Right. In 1990, it was sold to Matsushita Corporation for $6.13
billion.
But up until that time, they ruled Hollywood.
You know, this story starts in a part of California I'm not familiar with, near a national forest, I guess, and an Indian reservation or both. And mysteriously, three Secret Service agents were killed. Dude, give us the time and context where this was at and what was going on.
Okay, this was in on March 5th, 1983. Uh-huh. Queen Elizabeth, her motorcade was en route to Yosemite National Park, and she was going to visit the park there. And she had a motorcade, and there were three Secret Service agents in a car. And a Mariposa County Sheriff's vehicle was en route to meet them, and they collided head-on. And it killed the three Secret Service agents. The motorcade was about 25 minutes ahead of Queen Elizabeth's motorcade. And the sheriff's commander had crossed the center line and hit the second of the three Secret Service cars, and which went tumbling down a 10-foot embankment, and they were all killed. And that created quite a lot of publicity and press because it pretty much ruined the Queen's visit to Yosemite because they were paying attention to the accident rather than the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the judge who heard the families of the Secret Service agents sued Mariposa County. And Judge Coyle, who incidentally had been the lawyer for Curry Company at one time, and Curry Company was owned by MCA Corporation, and that was a concessionaire in Yosemite National Park. He ruled that Mariposa was 70% responsible and the Secret Service was 30%. And one of the Secret Service agents who had been in that motorcade, his best friend was one of the agents that was killed. And years later, he came to my home, and he wanted he was going to do a movie on that incident. And he did some investigating on it. And he learned that the sheriff's commander that had been in the car that collided with the three Secret Service agents' car was taking drugs, and that was covered up. So he was able to get the drugs records on the sheriff, and he provided them to me and so on and so forth. But that set me off, and he said that when he retired, he was going to pursue this story. And his name was Ron Williams. And the sheriff's deputy's father had been a military attaché to General Douglas MacArthur during World War II. And in Japan after the war, Colonel Sinclair had supervised the training of selected Japanese in intelligence gathering operations. And ultimately, the Secret Service agent and myself concluded that Colonel Sinclair had called upon high places to rescue his son from the Queen's accident investigation.
That, what do you mean by that exactly? I mean, what do you mean rescue his son?
Well,
his son's dead,
crack highway patrol investigators were all shut down.
Oh.
And basically the investigation was shut down by every agency that tried to pursue it. They were shut down by the California Attorney General.
And when did you come involved? When did you start in on this? I mean, you weren't there as that happened.
No.
I believe you were working on a newspaper, an area newspaper.
Right.
There.
A year later, in 1984, I became a reporter for the local newspaper up there. And deputies. Some of the sheriff's deputies kept coming up to me and wanting to meet with me secretly to discuss drug trafficking in Mariposa and actually all over Central California in all of the adjacent counties. And they were flying drugs in private planes into the local airports. And in our case, in Mariposa, the deputies were meeting the planes in the dead of night and unloading the drugs. They were coming in... They were grown in Peru, they were shipped to Costa Rica, and these private planes would go to Costa Rica, pick up the drugs, and bring them into all the airports all over Central California.
Well, you know,
this was in the mid-1980s.
Right, well, I was going to say, is this in the context of Iran-Contra, Reagan's, Ricky, what's his name, the guy that was confessed to running crack cocaine for the Contras, into the L.A., Los Angeles barrios and the Los Angeles neighborhoods. I mean, that was
very,
going on, I think, around that same time.
Very much so. Very much so. When I started investigating this, I really didn't want to get involved. Our newspaper was a family newspaper, and
right.
This was way, way, way out of my realm of investigation.
Well, way, way out. It's way, way
yeah.
out. I've worked for little country newspapers, Newsweek.
You know.
I mean, if you lose the bank ad, I mean, you're in big trouble. You know what I mean? Or the grocery store insert, you're in big trouble. And it's very, investigative journal, that's a big story.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah.
I've learned.
I found that they were connected to an organization that all this drug trafficking that no one could, two grand juries investigated this and sent it to the California Attorney General. Deputies were going up there complaining about the drug trafficking, and nobody could stop it. And I was thinking, this is strange. We win two world wars. We put a man on the moon, but we can't stop drugs, truck and trailer loads of drugs coming into our country. It didn't make sense, especially when it went on for so long. So ultimately, I tracked it to The Company, which was written up in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1982 under the heading of Story of Spies, Stolen Arms, and Drugs. And according to the reporter, Bill Wallace, the company consisted of about 300 members, many of them former military men or ex-police officers, with nearly $30 million worth of assets, including planes, ships, and real estate. And a federal drug agent said the organization had imported billions of dollars worth of narcotics from Latin America and was also involved in gun running and mercenary operations. And this was back in 82, so billions of dollars was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there was a reporter, I forgot his name, and I shouldn't, it's doing a disgrace to him, but he was uncovering this thing about in the Sacramento Bee, I believe, in the mid-80s. He eventually committed suicide, and that's his investigation.
That was Gary Webb.
That's right. That's
San
right.
Jose Mercury News.
And I apologize to the audience for not getting his name on the tip of my tongue, but that was happening. He was disclosing the cocaine and Contra connections with Central America, and then you're discovering this in a national forest, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
What part of California is that?
Mariposa. It's near Merced. It's 80 miles from Fresno, north of Fresno,
okay.
California.
Okay. Well, you know, and it's sort of like...
And the company was in Fresno.
And the company itself was, the organization was in Fresno.
Yes.
According to
also headquartered in Lexington, Kentucky.
Isn't that weird? And you're saying that this was not just... let's say, Contra, Central American Colombians or whoever, coming in, flying in, and just parachuting it in. This is actually, like you said earlier, being unloaded by the local county police department involving all kinds of people who are Americans.
Right.
Straight up. This is
right.
Like,
and there was also... actually, there was a man named Drew Thornton, who was a former narcotics officer from Lexington, that was parachuting cocaine into the country, but he died in the process. His chute didn't open. And he was a member of the company.
You said his chute didn't open or what?
His chute didn't open. And so he died, I think, with 44 pounds of cocaine on him.
I'm sorry.
And speaking of the Contras,
yeah.
There was the company was very much involved in, like I said, with Fresno and in California, and there was an Indian reservation, Cabazon Indian Reservation in Indio, which is I'd say a couple of hours drive from Fresno. They were in a joint venture with Wack and Hut Corporation, and they were developing proposals to build weapons on their sovereign Indian reservation in Indio, and also to build the first casino in California.
Right. That's what
and,
I thought was amazing. Yeah.
Right, and they were—they actually gave a demonstration there at the gun range in Indio in the early 80s to the Contras, to the Contra leaders.
Oh, my God.
The Nicaraguans showed up for that meeting, and they gave a demonstration on sniper rifles and night vision goggles. And,
sort of
and members of the company were there.
It's sort of like Blackwater before Blackwater. You know what I mean? The contractor over in Iraq. It's amazing. And, you know, I got to tell you, I used to, you know, as a PI, the grunt work is delivering subpoenas. I used to do that a lot. And I delivered subpoenas at Wack and Hut. Scariest experience I ever had every time I went there to deliver subpoenas.
Which location was that?
It was a weapons. Oh, they make ammunition up north, east of Kansas City, and I used to drive up there. It was always over domestic divorces and stuff, letting the guards know that their wives wanted something, you know. But it was always freaky, way over out of my league. I'll tell you that right now. But Wack and Hut was huge. It's huge up there, going through the different levels of. All the crazy stuff they do to protect the ammunition plant there.
I see.
Yeah, and I thought I'd share that with you on air because I thought that was, and you've been looking down their throat here. Not just that, but in the book, you're looking at some of the big shots and some of the people involved in the research and development of these strange, bizarre weapons, I guess, that were testing out in this Indian reservation.
Yes.
It's an incredible story. It's really one of the best books I've read. You know what I like about it? It doesn't come off as a conspiracy. It is a conspiracy book.
Well, it is a conspiracy, but it's not a theory. This group of people existed for 30 years, and they were very complex, and that's why they called them the octopus, because they had so many tentacles. But something, an organization and a system that complex is difficult to write about and simplify it. You know, you can't dumb it down. So it's all there, but it's all documented.
Now we go into this, and another triggering thing in the story that grabs the reader's attention, including mine, and I'm sure it got yours. It really is a murder, but at that time, the mysterious death of another investigative journalist who didn't commit suicide, although that's what everyone says, a guy named Danny Casolaro. Could you tell us about him?
Sure.
Involved in it too. Yeah.
My book is a chronology, actually, of an investigation, and as you said, that spanned off and on for about 18 years. But it's also an anatomy of Danny Casolaro's investigation. And I followed Danny's trail, interviewed most of his major sources, and I wanted to walk in his shoes and experience what he experienced so I could understand what he learned that caused his death. Danny was a Washington, D.C. journalist and a computer trade writer who began an investigation in the summer of 1990 into the theft of a revolutionary new software program that was actually the forerunner of artificial intelligence. It was called PROMIS, or Prosecutor's Management Information System, and it was contracted by the U.S. Department of Justice to upgrade the DOJ's outdated case management system. And the developer of PROMIS, the PROMIS software, was Bill Hamilton. He was the owner of Innslaw Company, and he was awarded a $10 million contract to install the program in 22 of the largest U.S. attorney's offices. And if that was successful, this was a pilot program, then they would install PROMIS in the remaining 74 federal prosecutors' offices around the country. But in March 1991, a computer scientist in California provided an affidavit to Hamilton's lawyer, and it was Elliot Richardson. He was the former attorney general, and stating that PROMIS had been modified and a backdoor or a Trojan horse had been installed in the software, and it was sold to foreign governments such as Israel, Canada, and other countries. And the purpose of the modification was allegedly so the U.S. government could secretly monitor the intelligence operations in those countries. And Casolaro jumped on this story, and he worked closely with Bill Hamilton to locate and identify the persons that were responsible for modifying the software and selling it worldwide. But Casolaro learned more than he bargained for. The software investigation led him into what I call a labyrinth, comprised of international spies, drug traffickers, money launderers, unsolved murders, dating as far back as 1981. And he called this the octopus because its tentacles reached into every facet of criminal enterprise, including the mafia and the Cali drug cartel. In August 1991, Casolaro filled his briefcase with documents, and he headed out to Martinsburg, Virginia, to bring back the head of the octopus, quote-unquote. This was what he told his closest friends, who said that he was ecstatic about something he had recently uncovered, but he didn't say what it was. And he never returned. So instead, on August 10th, 1991, his body was found in a blood-filled bathtub in room 517 of the Sheraton Hotel in Martinsburg, West Virginia. His wrists were slashed deeply 10 or 12 times. No papers were found in his hotel room or in his car. His housekeeper, Olga, had said that he had filled his briefcase with documents and took them with him when he left home. Yet the hotel room was clean and his body was embalmed, before relatives were notified, and all his documents and his briefcase were never recovered. The coroner ruled his death a suicide.
Yes.
Go ahead.
But somebody found something in his shoe, didn't they?
They sure did. They sure did. This is interesting because Danny, during the last 5 days of his life, had found a connection between Department of Justice official, a 17-year career official, who was the Director of International Affairs at the Department of Justice. And he had learned that this man was connected to the Cali drug cartel. And this information, which I'll get into later, this man was ultimately indicted by what Danny had learned. And it was on the front page of the Washington Post, but I'll get to that in a minute. You asked about the shoe.
Huh?
This information
yeah.
never reached the Department of Justice report. In September of 94, the U.S. Department of Justice released a 187-page report on Inslaw's allegations that their software was stolen by the Department of Justice and modified. But 62 pages of that report were devoted exclusively to the death of Danny Casolaro. And one interesting aspect of that report, they didn't report anything about the DOJ official, but one very interesting aspect of that report was that during forensic testing, the West Virginia State Police Crime Laboratory had found a folded piece of paper inside Mr. Casolaro's left shoe. The shoe had been found in room 517, where he died, next to the bed, and the writing was Danny's. And the outline on the piece of paper basically talked about the Cabazon Indian Reservation and the murder of Fred Alvarez. Danny had been planning to go to Indio just before he died to investigate this triple homicide of Fred Alvarez. And I obtained all of his notes, all of his remaining notes from the University of Missouri. And the Cabazon Indian Reservation is all over those notes. Anyways, what transpired in Indio ultimately became, and the Cabazon Wackanut Joint Venture became the subject of investigations by the U.S. Department of Justice, House Judiciary Committee on Inslaw, U.S. Customs, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, FBI, and police agencies all over the United States and media worldwide. And the seed money, Danny had learned this, and I, as following his trail, I learned this. The seed money for the Cabazon Casino originally came from a mafia member of the Gambino crime family who was also tied into MCA Corporation. And the Fred Alvarez triple homicide cold case file was reactivated in late 2007 when Rachel Begley, the daughter of one of the victims, Ralph Boger, convinced the Riverside Sheriff's Department to reopen the case. And Detective John Powers of the Central Homicide Unit, Cold Case Division, Riverside Sheriff's Department, was assigned to the case. And both Rachel and John shared all of their findings with me for 15 months, which is comprised in the last chapter of The Last Circle, Chapter 25.
Uh-huh.
So on, ultimately, 15 months later, on September the 26th, 2009, and this was 28 years after the triple homicide murders, a mafia, self-confessed mafia hitman, Jimmy Hughes, was arrested as he boarded a plane destined for Honduras at the Miami-Dade International Airport. And Hughes had been employed as the chief of security at the Cabazon Indian Reservation in 1981. And he had left the Cabazon Reservation after the murders and fled to Honduras, where he started a new life. Ultimately, though, like I said, he was arrested in 2009 and charged with 3 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy. And,
so he'd set up house or something down there in Honduras, by the way, through a mysterious group I have never heard of, but I do not doubt that it exists, something called the Christian Businessmen
We're Full Gospel Church. I'm looking for the name here on the notes.
FGBMFI, Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship International.
Yeah.
They're, at that time, they were a huge organization taking over most of Central America. And very powerful over there. Very, very powerful. And they sponsored
and
him to begin what he called Jimmy Hughes Ministries.
Yeah, this is the unbelievable part for me, was that he went down there earlier, and they, I guess he saved or whatever, went through some born-again experience. And there was, they were bragging about it, about who he was and how he, I guess, cleaned his, I don't know how you could clean, a murderer could clean his act up and then publicly get away with making these kind of statements. And then he came back to the United States, and that's when he was picked up.
Yeah, they had him flagged. They had him flagged through Interpol. When they reopened the case in 2007, they knew someday he might return, and he did, and they caught him. But you know, back in 1985, after the triple homicide, this was execution. They executed these three people: Fred Alvarez, Patty Castro, and Ralph Boger. Because they were opposing the new casino, they were opposing the weapons development on the reservation, and so basically they were going up against the powers that be under Reagan, a Wackenhut, and the mob.
Right.
And in any case, in 1985, Jimmy had was defending himself on NBC News, and he said that he was the bag man for the homicide, triple homicide. Actually, he was really the killer, according to the sheriff's department. But he said he was the bag man. And he said on television, which you can go on the internet and see him say this back in 1985 on NBC News, that the Alvarez homicide was an ordered assassination, quote-unquote, and that the hit was an authorized-backed government covert action. And he said this in 1985 on NBC News. So he felt very protected, very protected. He also went to work, basically got witness protection through the California Attorney General. He then went over to the FBI. He then fled. He then fled to Guatemala, where his mother lives, and then started a mission, Jimmy Hughes Ministries in Honduras under FGBMFI. And one of the things at his own website, at the FGBMFI website, he talks about, I'll read it to you. Hold on a minute, let me find it.
Sure.
He says, one day I had a contract on a man. After a 6-year hitch in the military, I became a professional hitman for the mafia. I collected money, hurt a lot of people, and saw a lot of blood. I know what it's like to cut the throat of a man, see a man die, or throw a man in the trunk of a car and take him to his death. I allowed myself to do whatever was necessary. One day I had a contract on a man. They had paid me a lot of money to kill this person. I traveled over many states and walked into the man's house one day, pulled out my pistol, and put a bullet in everybody's head. There were many people there that day because he was having a party. As I stood there with the gun in my hand, I suddenly realized that all those people were dead. They had died instantly. I had been paid to kill one man, but he had killed half a dozen people. The rest had just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. In any case, this man, this is, you can go any time of the day and see this on the internet at his website. It's still there. In any case, after he was arrested, I figured after 18 years it was time to finish the book. I could close it out. I had a happy ending to my book. Someone was finally brought to justice.
Right.
Not so.
Right.
On July 1st, 9 months after Hughes' arrest, the 29th anniversary, when they found those three bodies in 1981, he was let go. He was released from jail. The California Attorney General's Department decided that they were not going to prosecute him. He'd been in jail for 9 months. And they simply dropped the case in court on July 1st.
What was the official?
They would not say. they would not say. As a matter of fact, in the Desert Sun, the following day, on July 2nd, they wrote that the officials refused to divulge new evidence that led to the dismissal.
And so there's the victim of this, one of the surviving members, I think, of a family. Is that a family member? Or
Rachel Begley, she attended the hearing.
Yeah.
She gave a very profound statement.
Is she related to one of them, or she was friends with one of these three in the triple homicide on the reservation?
It was Fred Alvarez and his friends, which was Ralph Boger and Patty Castro, who were with him at the time and were executed. Fred was going to be going to a lawyer the following day on July the 1st of 1981. He had an appointment to meet with a lawyer to provide evidence for what was going on at the reservation with Wackenhut and the mob and Cabazon and so on. And he died the night before with Ralph Boger and Patty. In any case, Ralph was the father of Rachel Begley, who got the case reopened in 2007. So she and I attended the hearing on July the 1st of this year. And the Deputy Attorney General was there, lots of media, and she gave a statement. Basically, she said she feared for the safety of herself and others if they released Jimmy. They would give her no reason. They gave no reason publicly in the court other than they had lost confidence in their ability to prosecute Jimmy Hughes. Now, this man is a self-confessed mafia hitman that advertises at his own website, you know. And she had actually, Rachel, had actually gone. I met with him one time when he was in the United States. She had gone to one of his meetings. FGBMFI meetings. And this gets involved, but this is very interesting. He was there with the commander, one of the generals, pardon me, from Honduras, who ultimately was the planner of the coup that took place in Honduras last year.
Oh, I've been covering that, Mike. Really?
Right.
Oh my God.
And the general that was with Jimmy at that meeting that she went and confronted him was the commander who planned, strategized the Honduras coup last year.
Throughout Mel, the democratically elected president of Honduras, they flew him out in his pajamas and he felt lucky to be alive.
Well, this was General Daniel Lopez Carballo of Honduras and an FGBMI member and co-speaker with Jimmy Hughes in Fresno. So Rachel went to this meeting, and she confronted him, but she had a camcorder hidden in her purse, and she said, I understand that you were the bag man in my father's murder. And she went there with Fred Alvarez's son. And Jimmy proceeded to say this was a mafia hit, and basically confessed on her camcorder.
Again.
So that was going to be evidence in court. And with all of this evidence and witnesses all over the place, you know, and they dropped the case. So it's still a mystery, but this isn't over because one of the reasons they had to prosecute through the Department of Justice, or pardon me, the California Attorney General, was because it would have been a conflict of interest if they had gone through the local Riverside District Attorney's Office, because the district attorney at that time, Rod Pacheco, was Jimmy Hughes' cousin. So they couldn't have the cousin prosecute his cousin. So they went over to the California Attorney General's Office, who dumped the case in July. So Rod Pacheco's been voted out, and as of 2011, there will be a new district attorney, and although I have no inside information on this at all, this case was dropped without prejudice. In other words, it can be refiled by the judge when he dropped it.
If Rachel can stay alive that long.
Yeah, and she wanted, what she and her lawyer wanted was they wanted a preliminary hearing where the evidence could be presented. He never even got a preliminary hearing. I think that the DOJ is embarrassed by this case.
Well, I would say, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It sounds to me like this guy's some sort of snitch for the federal level people, like the DOJ, somebody.
And could you give us, I mean, you mentioned the name Elliot Richardson, who's Inslaw's attorney. Well, you know, he's got a batting record himself, you might say. I guess he's a former U.S. attorney general. And, it was all kinds of conflicts of interest and all kinds of federal, you know, the customs, the FBI, the DOJ, they're all involved in this. And do you think maybe this Jimmy Hughes was just working as an informant? It's hard to believe that they would protect him for that. I mean, like you, rogue elephant, you know, or something. You know what I mean? He went wild.
I could speculate.
Yeah,
privately, but I don't really want to speculate publicly because I wouldn't want to ruin their case. I don't want to take it into the realm of speculation because if I'm right, I might ruin their strategy if they decide to refile.
Well, my strategy would be just to put him up and make him. That's sick. That is really just sick that these people have been allowed to just run loose for so many years and do this stuff, especially to, the people like Alvarez and them who were just basically trying to slow down and stop all this, I don't know what it would call, property speculation, building casinos, development, and the mysterious, now, who is that one guy? I can't pronounce his name. He's an Italian. That's a bizarre
Michael Riccano-Sciuto?
Yeah. I went over and over that name practicing to say it, and I said, I still can't say it. Yeah, Riccano-Sciuto. Yeah.
Italian.
No kidding. Sciuto. Now, that guy's supposed to be some sort of genius. He was involved. Tell us a little bit about him in your book. He's a fascinating character, too.
Okay. He has two areas that he is very proficient in, and one is computer science, and the other is drugs. This guy really knows his drugs.
I'm sorry, Sherry. I'm having fun with this because this is so real. It's got to be true. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But he's a scientific genius, and there was actually a time when Wackenhut executives sent him to Picatinny Arsenal to give a demonstration, to give a rail gun. He actually showed a board presentation of the rail gun, and Dr. Harry Fair, who was the head of the weapons development there at Picatinny Arsenal, said that he was a potential national resource as a scientist. And that came in a Wackenhut letter to me. So I know this was true. So they basically recruited him out at the reservation. And his partner in crime, so to speak, was a man named Robert Booth Nichols. They knew each other since 1967, over 30 years. And Robert Booth Nichols was a international intelligence operative involved in money laundering, drug trafficking, investigated by the FBI. And this is another area where the DOJ dropped the ball. This was where they were wiretapping MCA executives, one of whom was a man named Eugene Giaquinto. And Eugene Giaquinto was the president of MCA Home Entertainment Division. And he was business partners with Robert Booth Nichols in Los Angeles. And the FBI was investigating organized crime infiltration of the entertainment industry in Los Angeles in the early 1980s. And they wiretapped Giaquinto. And they wiretapped Robert Booth Nichols. And they captured on the wiretap the fact that Nichols was delivering to them printouts from the Department of Justice on their investigation. In other words, they would give reports to the Department of Justice This was under the Reagan administration. And those reports would circulate back to the mob. Giaquinto would brag on the wiretaps that his best friend, that he had grown up with John Gotti, the head of the Gambino crime family.
I want to interrupt you just for a second. This guy, let's tell me this guy, Rio Shuto,
right,
or whatever.
Uh-huh.
He is telling you this in jail, isn't he?
No, I learned this.
This isn't just a jailhouse confession, right? He's trying to.
No, actually, you read chapter 20. You read chapter 22 of The Last Circle. I interviewed the two U.S. Attorneys and DOJ prosecutors who did the wiretaps. They tell me this story. This is out of their own mouths in chapter 22.
I will. You can count on it. And everybody listened.
They wiretapped, and this is what they heard. And so, ultimately, and this is the key here, this is the capper.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately, they hear Giaquinto tell his friend, Martin Bacall, that he's sick of this FBI investigation, and he's going to call Edwin Meese and have it shut down. And that's on the wiretaps. Edwin Meese at that time was the United States Attorney General under Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And 2 weeks later, that FBI investigation was shut down. Now, we don't know if Edwin Meese said, oh, yes, okay, Mr. Mafia Man, I will shut down the investigation for you. We don't know that, but we do know that it was shut down. And we do know that on the wiretaps, Giaquinto stated that he was going to have that FBI investigation of MCA shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shut down. And that's in chapter 22. And I didn't get that from Reconosciuto. I got that directly from the prosecutors who handled the wiretaps, who were shut down. And they haven't told that to anybody in 20-some-odd years.
Right.
They opened up, and I'll tell you why they opened up, was because I had obtained the wiretaps, not only the wiretap summaries, which Danny Castellaro had had. His brother, Dr. Tony Castellaro, had sent them to the University of Missouri, and they were archived there, and I purchased them from the university. And Danny had had those wiretaps. But I also obtained the actual transcripts and the memorandums. And that the entire wiretaps, what's in them, discussing the mob and all their internal mob telephone conversations, as well as movies, as well as various things, is in the chapter entitled The Wiretaps.
Right.
In The Last Circle, so it talks about that.
It's a great book. I mean, I'm telling you, it's a page-turner. I've been reading it. I stay up late at night trying to follow this and go, and I've stuck post-it notes in it and everything. I'm like going, this is one of those they make movies about, maybe four or five movies, because it goes, and like an octopus, it goes into very many directions that are frightening. It really is frightening. I've been trying to sort out this guy. You mentioned him, Nichols. And you say he's an intelligence operative. Well, I mean, did he actually formally work as an agent with the CIA or anything? Or what was he, just another one of these rogue agents?
He was in an organization called FIDCO, First Intercontinental Development Corporation. And his business partners were Robert Mayhew, CEO of Howard Hughes Enterprises. His business partner in FIDCO was Michael McManus, who at that time was assistant to President Reagan at the White House. He was legit. And they were they developed that corporation for purposes of having a presence in Lebanon. They were allegedly going to help with the reconstruction of Beirut and cities around Beirut, the redevelopment of that country. But in actuality, they were providing money to the president of Lebanon to get a hostage released, as well as operating drug sting operations.
Yeah, I remember the controversy around the hostages and that. I'm old enough to remember that.
And when you see the actual documents in the back of the book, you'll notice that they give Robert Booth Nichols' telex number for the president of Lebanon to communicate with them through Robert Booth Nichols. He had a listening post in Marina Del Rey. And Nichols also was... Okay, this is something that's very key to Danny Castellaro's story.
Yeah.
And this was where Danny had learned from Bill Hamilton, and Bill had asked him to check it out, that this Department of Justice official, Director of International Affairs, was hooked in with the Cali Cartel and Robert Booth Nichols. And Danny called, this was the last 5 days of his life, he called Robert Booth Nichols, who was his, he had been interviewing Nichols for months, and this was one of his main sources. And he confronted Nichols about his relationship with this Department of Justice official and the Cali Cartel. And Nichols told him, you've got to drop this case, this investigation, or you're going to die. And Danny then called the FBI in Los Angeles. He called Thomas Gates, the FBI agent who was handling the wiretaps of Nichols. And he also called Richard Stavin, who was supervising the wiretaps of Nichols and MCA. And he spoke with both of them just days before he died. And he said to them, these were the same guys that had their wiretaps shut down. And he said to them that he felt threatened by Nichols' statement to him to drop his investigation. And so when I learned what he learned, I provided that information to a customs agent in 1993. And this customs agent pursued that story, that case, and followed that Department of Justice official, former department. By now, he was a prestigious lawyer in Washington, D.C., retired Department of Justice official, 17 years. And he found that, in fact, he was laundering money for the Cali Cartel. On June the 6th of 1995, on the front page of the Washington Post, his indictment was written up on the front page that he was laundering money for the Cali Cartel, drug conspiracy, and racketeering. And he was indicted. And that was literally as a result of Danny's original investigation the last 5 days of his life.
Wow. Castellaro was really some kind of guy, wasn't he?
And Michael Riconosciuto, his involvement in all of that was he had allegedly been with Nichols when Nichols provided money to this DOJ official in connection with the Cali Cartel. They were to stop the extradition of Gilberto Rodriguez and Jose Londoño. They were the leaders of the Cali Cartel, and being the Director of International Affairs, he was DOJ official was instructed not to extradite them back into the United States. And allegedly, Michael Riconosciuto was present there. So he had brought this information to Bill Hamilton because Michael had just been arrested and for having a methamphetamine lab, and he was going to trade this information to the FBI to get into the witness protection program. So he asked Bill Hamilton to gather more information on this DOJ official. So Bill, being pressed for time, asked Danny, and this was on August the 5th, asked Danny to check out this DOJ official. And that was the last thing Danny ever worked on before he died.
Wow. Where is Riconosciuto or whatever? Where is this? Are these people? Who's alive yet? I mean, what's
Robert Booth Nichols died mysteriously in Geneva last February on Valentine's Day in Geneva, Switzerland, in a hotel room, a blow to the head. He's allegedly dead. And Michael Riconosciuto is still in jail. He's in California, in a California prison. His lawyer is still working on appeal to get him out of prison. He was put in jail in prison. Well, actually, he was arrested, I think it was in March of 1991. So he's been incarcerated ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
And
Jimmy Hughes.
Well, Jimmy Hughes is, well, I don't know where, he was released July the 1st in Indio, California. I would assume he's back in Honduras, and I don't know if he's going to be coming back into this country again soon, but he's very, very protected in Honduras. So I would assume he's back there at Jimmy Hughes Ministries. So who else?
You received a threat, and it was sort of in your press release, distributed by your publisher, said you had to relocate for a short period of time. How did you receive that threat? And what was it?
Okay, that's in the
if you
chapter.
Want, if you want to talk about it, if you don't, you don't have to.
I'm gonna keep it very brief because it's pretty involved. But that is explained in detail in the chapter called Rendezvous with the Underworld, where I personally met with Robert Booth Nichols at his home in Sherman Oaks, California, and interviewed him at length, and on the phone also. And afterwards, he had told me when I left his apartment that I was not to discuss that interview with anybody, or else I would end up like Danny Castellaro. When I left, one of the people who had been present at that interview told Michael Mercanashito about it in detail, and basically blabbed it. And at that point in time, Michael and Robert Booth Nichols were... Michael was trying to trade information on Nichols to get out of prison and get into witness protection. And Nichols was well aware of this. And Nichols was suing Thomas Gates at that time for investigating him. So Nichols was quite serious when he said, I don't want you discussing this with anybody else. So it got out. It got back to Michael Mercanashito through one of the individuals that was present at that interview. He was a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle. And he provided that to Michael Mercanashito. So I had to, at that point, Mercanashito's wife, Bobby Mercanashito, became very concerned. And someone told her, I don't know who it was, she knew Nichols, she knew his people, etc. She called me and she said, they're coming to kill you.
Yeah.
And I didn't know whether to believe her or not, you know. I'm up in Mariposa and this was really getting out there. And I was going into, you know, a new dimension here. And so I really wanted to shrug it off. And she kept calling back and telling me, if you don't get out of that house and run, you're going to die. So I thought, okay, I think maybe I better do something. So I went to Galveston for 3 months.
Now, how many years were you working on this at the time when this threat came at you? You've been on it quite
a while.
Let me see.
This would have been, I think, around 92, 93. Yeah, 93, late 92, early 93. So I actually started investigating the drug trafficking in Mariposa in 1984. In 86, I was actually pretty... In 86, there was a group called the Decency and Government Group in Mariposa comprised of honest deputies and former grand jury foremen who had filed the largest lawsuit in California history against the Sheriff's Department and the FBI and various agencies in California for not investigating the drug trafficking in Mariposa. So I was pursuing that and writing about it as a reporter. And so I was deeply involved in that aspect of it in 86. But it wasn't until November of 1991 that I was introduced to the octopus. And that was when Michael Mercanashito called me on December the 1st, I believe it was 1991. He called me, collect. From jail, he hadn't gone to trial yet. He had been arrested in March, and he called me December the 1st and told me about the company in Fresno and proceeded to name all the people that were operating the meth labs in my community. And so that was when I got my first introduction to the octopus. And after a couple of years, I decided I was going to do a book on it.
Well, we're going to go, and I want to discuss what you're working on now, but first I want to finish up with a grand review written by Dennis Moore in the East County Magazine called The San Diego Bookshelf Reporter Reveals Powerful Conspiracy in a True Life Thriller, The Last Circle. And he finishes up his review. It's a great review, too, by the way, Sherry. And it says, with that in mind, it became clear to Seymour that the only avenue left to expose the history of the octopus was through publishing this book, The Last Circle, because for decades, major media, government committees, U.S. representatives, and senators had ignored the legacy of war, corruption, and greed left behind by the octopus, which she says still flourishes today. And I'm going to skip to the last paragraph, just two paragraphs down. She did take a brief hiatus. She did take a brief hiatus in San Diego after this threat was made. Obviously, she escaped this fate before I actually sat next to her and talked with her a few weeks ago at a meeting of the San Diego Writers Editors Guild. She impressed me as someone who would go to great lengths to get at the truth. This is an exciting true life thriller from end to end. That is no kidding, listeners. I'm telling you, this is an incredible book that will stay on your bookshelf the rest of your life. It really is. And Sherry, I mean, what can you be topping it with this? I mean, my goodness, you had a book earlier that's out of print now. Could you tell us the name of that? I know intrepid bookophiles out here will dig up. What was the name of that first book you wrote?
That was called Committee of the States, Inside the Radical Right. It was about a colonel who was a staff officer to General Douglas MacArthur in World War II, and he trained the guerrilla fighters in the Philippines during World War II. And then
who published that?
That was Camden Place Communications Incorporated. And he then returned to the United States and started the identity movement, Posse Comitatus. He actually indoctrinated Richard Butler, head of Aryan Nations.
Yeah.
He drew Butler into that movement. He was the original.
Oh,
yeah. And so anyways, I wrote the story of his life as well as I as a reporter, I was assigned to cover his trial in Las Vegas for 3 weeks. And after attending the trial for 3 weeks, I decided to do the book on him.
And what are you? That's an amazing way. And what are you? You told me earlier you're working on something new. We can't talk too much about it, but could you give us an overview of what could you possibly? More dangerous. I mean, this is. What are you working on? Can you tell me a little bit about?
Sure, sure. In 1995, I was hired as a private detective by a client to investigate the Oklahoma City bombing that occurred on April the 19th of 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And I traveled 11,500 miles across the United States by car interviewing people. And also I was communicating closely with Stephen Jones's investigator. Stephen Jones was Timothy McVeigh's lawyer. And Jones had an investigator, and I was communicating very closely with him because they all purchased my book, Committee of the States, and they were reading it during McVeigh's trial. And so they were communicating with me and asking me questions, and they were sharing information with me. And one of the things they shared, essentially, was that they were investigating was sending tape recorded messages back and forth to Timothy in jail. And I pursued that, and ultimately that man has been as of last year in 2009, that man was arrested for recruiting skinheads to send a bomb through the mail to a diversity center in Phoenix, Arizona. He was arrested by the BATF, and he is now going to trial in November for bombing, for sending a bomb to the diversity center, and it did blow up. It severely injured an employee there. And so he's going on trial for a bombing. He was, everything I learned through investigators, as well as Danny Colson, who was the very FBI agent, who was the very first person, FBI agent, to be assigned to the Oklahoma City bombing case. And he connected it to LOM City. And when he connected it to LOM City, he was pulled off the case. Anyways, I went to LOM City and photographed it and so on and so forth. And ultimately, I learned
that LOM City, listeners, is a far-right, white, Aryan, well, loose terms, but basically a Christian, extremist Christian identity compound, armed to the teeth at the time. I don't know if it is anymore. And I happen to know that several of the anti-abortion activists around the clinics up in Kansas City, Missouri, that I used to protect, would brag about going down there. I thought I'd throw that at you, Sherry. And it was very populous down, I guess, around the Ozarks. And you can tell us what you want. I don't want you to tell anything to get yourself in trouble. But
basically, I'm going to be covering that trial of this man who committed a bombing in 2004, arrested in 2009, but he was very much involved with Timothy McVeigh. And from all reports that I have come across, he recruited McVeigh. And now recruited in 2004 for another bombing, and now he's under arrest. So basically that's what my new book called The Coup is about.
The Coup. And as it stands now, do you have a publisher, and is it, do you know if you have a publisher?
Yes, bless his heart. Chris Milligan at Trine Day, who published the last
book. I knew Chris.
No fear.
No fear. And
I call him Lionheart.
He is. He really is, and he's a real dear. I just finished earlier his book, listeners, Radical Peace, People Refusing War, by William T. Hathaway, which is so far into the underground. He lives in, let's put it like in Denmark or Holland or the Netherlands, in that area. And I can't even get an interview with him because he's so underground and poor, helping deserters from the United States Army and military service get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. He's doing that literally. And that book is also published by Trine Day, Radical Peace, People Refusing War. It's called, Trine Day, by the way, it's called The Little Library of Suppressed Books. And Sherry Seymour is a load of great stuff. And Sherry, I want to thank you so much for coming on, really, honestly.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I very much enjoyed it with you.
We'll have another time together, I'm sure, as these things develop, because it's just so fascinating, the subjects you take on and your background and stuff. It really is the way you factually document your stuff. Listeners, bear in mind, conspiracy can be merely, as Gorby Dahl said once, a whisper, a wink, and a nod. It doesn't take much to make a conspiracy and an agreement in today's world, especially with our technology. People are transferring billions of dollars with the stroke of a keyboard. Capital moves quickly, and it's very hard to track it. We're truly gifted to have writers like Sherry Seymour on our side. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you, Mike.
Have a good evening. I'm going to get back to playing some music in the remaining minutes. And, listeners, I want you to tune in. We've got another Trine Day book coming up this October 27th with Douglas Valentine. I'm telling you, Trine Day Books is a little library of big books. things that will really keep you up at night. They're great page turners. And what's great, almost all of them are factually based, just like Sherry Seymour's. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll get back to some old-time music. I hope you enjoy the program. This program will be archived permanently at the archive, internetarchive.org, as well as the radioforall.net network. And as always, stay tuned. You'll never know what you find on Wednesday Mystery. Have fun. Hold on. Here we go with something. Here's a little one, an old one.
Sorry, I was just reading this book. A friend just gave me a book about George Orwell, you know, the guy who wrote 1984 and Animal Farm. Orwell was on BBC radio in the 1940s, and I guess on one show he did an imaginary interview with famous satirist Jonathan Swift, you know, the guy who wrote Gulliver's Travels. And they were having a bit of an argument on whether British humanity had made any important progress since Jonathan Swift's time. And Orwell says, "But don't you find that the mass of the people are more intelligent than they were, or at least better educated? How about the newspapers and the radio? Surely they have opened people's minds a little. There are very few people in England now who can't read." And Swift is just not impressed. He says, "That is why they are so easily deceived. Your ancestors 200 years ago were full of barbarous superstitions, but they would not have been so credulous as to believe your daily newspapers. Hello, my name's Tom Clammer, and besides being a fan of Radio Free Kansas, I'm the producer and host of a radio show myself called Tell Somebody. Tell Somebody is a public affairs show, and we broadcast on 90.1 FM KKFI, a community radio station in Kansas City, Missouri. And KKFI also streams on the internet at kkfi.org. And my show is podcast, so you can download or listen to shows anytime you like with links at www.tellsomebody.us. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit today, but let's thin the crowd out a little bit first. I'm going to ask you some questions and then ask you to hold your hands up if the answer to any of these questions is yes. Now I know you're probably listening to my disembodied voice on a little speaker coming out of your computer or something and wondering, what the heck is this guy talking about? He can't see my hand, I hope. Well, trust me, we have our ways. I can tell. So just listen up. All right. Now, any of you out there who have young children and care, even just a little bit, about their future, hold up your hands. Okay, now the rest of you, do any of you know anybody with young children, and do you care even a little bit about those other people's children's futures? Okay, now, is there anybody out there who knows of any economic, political, or social issue that you care about even just a little bit? Hold up your hands. Okay. Okay, now, you three guys with your hands down, you can leave. Everybody else, listen up. What I want to talk to you about is, and okay, you can put your hands down now. What I want to talk to you about is independent media. You know, what people like Madison and Jefferson characterized as the free press, the organs that they hoped would result in an informed public. Back then, mostly newspapers, and nowadays we'd probably have to include things like broadcast radio, blog talk radio, the internet, and even, on all too rare occasions, television, sometimes. Jesse Jackson, Jr., speaking at a media reform conference, said, "Information is oxygen for the mind, and we are asphyxiating, choking from lack of good information." And I don't have to spell out that problem for you, I hope. You must already have some sense of that, or you probably wouldn't be listening here today, right? I had the opportunity on my show a couple of times to interview Michael Copps, one of the commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission, one of the all-too-rare genuine public servants in government agencies these days, and he exhorted my listeners, no matter what their main issue of concern was, to make media reform their number two issue, because their number one issue was going to be filtered and spun and either explained or distorted or ignored through the media. What former CIA analyst Ray McGovern calls, mostly these days, the FCM, fawning corporate media.
This is Fred Whitehead signing on again for Radio Free Kansas. Today I want to read a lead article for an issue of my now defunct newsletter called People's Culture that was published in the year 2004. I've long been interested in the utopian communities of the United States and elsewhere, actually. We've all heard of the Shakers, and we know probably something about their furniture, maybe even about their music. But there were hundreds of communities like the Shakers scattered around the country. And this is a kind of meditation on the meaning of those communities and the kind of enduring sense in American heritage. The essay is called Somewhere in America, Our Communal Heritage. A few years ago, I went over to the University of Kansas to hear a talk by some Yugoslavian professor who was offering a sort of overview of modern political theories that he thought relevant to our circumstances today. He seemed to have an exaggerated estimate of pragmatism and furthermore dismissed utopian ideas altogether. I couldn't help but query him and to ask if we dismissed utopias outright, how would we be able to really change anything in what presently existed? Professor-like, he dismissed the question as irrelevant, a relic of outmoded thinking. I thought at the time, if he was the best that Yugoslavia had to offer, they were in real trouble. One of the classic discussions is Engels' small book, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific, which more or less dismisses the utopians as impractical middle-class dreamers. The scientific variety, by contrast, aimed not at constructing an Eden in some small corner of the world, but focused on the transformation of entire societies. I remember talking about Engels' views with the late Truman Nelson. A self-defined, unrepentant Marxist who in the 1950s undertook a defense of the utopian tradition in his novel Passion by the Brook. Truman said that Engels had badly misled him for years because unless you try socialism in a place, you will never know if it will work. That is, the small-scale experiments were essential toward the creation of a new society. Truman still resolutely defended a wholesale revolution. You can see the Truman Nelson reader in paperback from the University of Massachusetts Press. But he had a strong feeling for all those who went about the work of putting their beliefs into concrete practice wherever they were. Of course, there was a tremendous variety of such experiments, hundreds of them in the United States alone at the high point in the mid-19th century. They included the Shakers, who built large-scale agricultural and small industrial communities in New England, and as far south as central Kentucky. The Amana colonies in eastern Iowa were founded by the community of true inspiration. In southwest Indiana, on the banks of the Wabash River, George Rapp started the town of Harmony, and it almost immediately became a major commercial center for that part of the country. Similarly, the various kinds of Anabaptists settled in rural areas. Some of these, such as the Hutterites, still prosper in the Dakotas and up into Canada. What distinguishes all of these is that they were Christian communists. The perfectionist, John Humphrey Noyes, who founded the Oneida community, observed that the religiously based experiments lasted longer than the secular ones because they had a spiritual basis which unified them and gave them a core of beliefs. In the late 1980s, the Soviets sent a television documentary team to the Hutterites, who number 35,000 and thus are a substantial group. And they asked the Hutterites, "You make communism and agriculture work. How do you do it?" Indeed, they had done it for almost 500 years. To be sure, the Hutterites have their problems too. A strict biblical and rather patriarchal view of the world, etc. But like anything else human, there will be positives and negatives. One problem of the utopias was that they often depended on a central charismatic personality. When that person died, they tended to give over their communal forms for the private property that prevailed everywhere around them. Even though most of these experiments, quote, failed, unquote, insofar as they no longer exist in their pure form, it's interesting that most of them still exist as active, significant historic sites. I have visited them all around America, at Bishop Hill in Illinois, Bethel in Missouri, the Amanas in Iowa, the Shaker Towns, one at Pleasant Hill in Kentucky is especially splendid, Zor in Ohio, Salem in North Carolina, and New Harmony in Indiana. In each instance, the visitor is able to gain a real sense of what those communities were like, what was so appealing about them. They devoted much effort to making their villages beautiful. That is, aesthetics were at the core of the experiment. In the present-day left, that is almost never brought up, even as a remote goal. This issue of aesthetics is important because contemporary America is so ugly and depressing. Whether we live in the burnout and rotting inner cities or in the sterile suburbs, we have to do something about the everyday quality of life for people, what kind of environment they live in. Shaker music is more popular now than it ever was before, in part because it is lovely and optimistic and somehow pure. Their furniture is legendary, and originals are high-priced auction items, though reproductions are easily available. The creation of a new society at Amana meant that ordinary members of the community could have inspirations. These were written down, collected, and studied as guides to life. New Harmony contributed much to the advancement of science. The first geological surveys of several Midwestern states were undertaken from there. The town's Working Men's Institute, founded in 1838, still exists as an important art and industrial museum, library, and archive of the rural socialist movement. New Harmony's accomplishments are too lengthy to give here, but practically the entire town is on the National Register of Historic Places. Many of its buildings have been restored and are small scientific, cultural, and historical museums as well. Another aspect of the utopias that remains attractive was how peaceful and productive they were. Everyone worked except those who were elderly or sick. I believe they accomplished so much because they drew together human labor in a cooperative manner. Numerous innovations such as washing machines, clothespins, and the like originated in these utopias. They persist as examples of how such things were actually achieved on American soil. Of course, there were many negative aspects of their experience, too. In spite of the impulse toward peace and unity, there was division and conflict. We should learn from that, too. But to dismiss their achievements as some Marxists do is a major strategic error and ignores an important and still vital aspect of our own cultural history. Achievements can be registered on a micro scale long before they are realized on one that is macro. It's curious that after the collapse of socialism in so many countries, the word community should become almost a buzzword. The market has not quite satisfied every need, every human longing. Even those around the Clintons have latched onto this. Hillary is infamous among rightists for repeating the mantra, "It takes a village to raise a child." There's something about that expression that drives them crazy. They prefer that we all be closed up in little suburban cocoons. And in the same issue, I reprinted a poem by the Los Angeles poet Don Gordon, which deals with this same issue. It's entitled, "We Are Not Ready." We are not ready for the collective. It requires a state of grace light years from these war cries on the violent desert. The people of the mind live in its cerebral caves. When the door opens on the real world, they hear the night-riding mares. The shell hole neurosis we seek between the dream and the fact. In the debris, in the smoke signals, in chaos, we sleep and imagine the landscape of the commune in its glory, rising with each century and dying with it. It demands more than a belief in our sleep to enter the peaceable kingdom. Or like the young Keats, we may pursue ourselves, a fantasy in glazed ware, around and around an urn, and ash.
We'll finish that with Jim Herman and the Herminators playing Common Ground. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. Many thanks to Sherry Seymour with her book, The Last Circle. By the way, that comes from Dante's Inferno. Look it up. You'll find out what The Last Circle means. But here, on a gentler note, we'll close. We'll see you, Ben, on... See you again on Saturday, this coming Saturday, high noon. Here's Jim Herman and the Herminators, Common Ground.
Conversation with our feet on common ground. All the things that we agree on, not the things that tear us down. We need to see common ground. Can't let the dream of love go down. What our free world was built up on was the thought of freedom now. Hard work and concentration and the sweat from every brow. We need to see common ground. Can't let the dream of love go down. Well, we got some major problems. Threats to life and limb abound. How we solve them is our future. If we start from common ground. We need to see common ground. Can't let the dream of love go down. Leaders from the right say that our might will make things right.